But testifying in public under oath in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee with the American people watching, that's an enormous amount of pressure. Is she willing to go that far?
She's willing to do what she needs to do. She is willing to hopefully tell her story in a manner that is a fair proceeding. Unfortunately, what we're already hearing this morning is that the Republicans intend to play hardball. They intend to grill her. This is not an exercise that is designed to get at the truth. This is an exercise that's designed to terrify somebody who's already been traumatized.
That was Deborah Katz, the lawyer for Christine Blasey Ford, speaking today on CBS This Morning with host Nora O'Donnell. Ford, of course, has come forward to accuse Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of forcing himself on her 35 years ago when he was 17 and she was 15. Hello, everyone. Matt Welch here. Welcome to the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. Kicking off a week that Kyle Smith this morning predicted is going to be longer than a CVS receipt. Joining me to venture bravely out into the heavily mined crossroads of sexual assault and public policy is Catherine Mangu Ward, Peter Suderman, and Nick Gillespie. Hi, everyone.
Hi,
Good
Matt.
Good morning.
Good Monday.
You sound like you believe that, Peter. Catherine, you're highest up on the masthead, so I will give you the initial shot to ruin your career. First, should a single source high school allegation from 35 years ago be enough to potentially derail the confirmation of a Supreme Court nominee who has already gone through a round of Senate hearings?
I don't know. That's... Like, I think I speak for America when I say, I don't know. It's very hard. So, yeah, I mean, this is, we'll obviously get into the nitty gritty because I think in the end, the answer is somewhere in the nitty gritty. And that's unsatisfying for all of us who are currently engaged in a high stakes culture war. And this is the latest and perhaps most important front in this particular culture war. And feelings are running very high. And I think both sides have a good case. And whether or not a person remembers a thing that happened when they were drunk when they're 17 is probably not the thing that the future of the republic should hinge on. And yet here we are.
Nick, you have already written about this because you are a productive member of the Reason journalistic community. But you've been saying that kind of the first question, the primary question about all this is whether this allegation, if proven true, should be disqualifying. So, Nick, if this allegation is proven true, should it be disqualifying?
Yeah, it's a lot easier to ask that question of other people than to answer it. So we'll come back to you, Matt. But, you know, part of me says it should not be disqualifying in this sense that based on the account that we have, which is hers, eventually nothing happened. Beyond what was described, which is awful behavior, and it was awful behavior in the early 80s or late 70s, whenever it took place. And it's not something that should be tolerated. But then given everything else that we know about Kavanaugh's career, there are, you know, this is not part of a pattern. It is not part of recurring behavior. Nothing like that has come up. So it's, it seems kind of odd to, pin everything to that, I think. Having said that, it's also the case that this is the type of stuff, partly because it is a serious accusation at a serious moment, not just for Brett Kavanaugh and the Supreme Court, but for the Me Too movement and for gender discussions, as well as for politics. I think, we need, I think a hearing, one done as publicly as possible, would make sense. And I push back on the lawyer saying that, this whole thing is set up to intimidate my witness. It's like, no, it really isn't. Like, and if you get to a point where you are not allowed to actually talk with somebody who's making a very serious accusation, and there are like reasonable doubts about many things because she herself can't remember everything. It only surfaced in her life, at least to other people in 2012 in a therapy counseling setting with her husband. We don't know why she came forward to talk about it at that point or in what context and what that means. Memory is slippery, et cetera. I think we need a, you know, we need to take it seriously. But then the idea to just say like, oh, well, to even make her talk about it in front of senators is attacking her. That's playing hardball. That's bullshit. I mean, you can't have it every possible way where it's like you get to make certain accusations and then you don't ever have to actually clarify them or give the other person the opportunity to weigh in and give their version of events.
Peter, there's a process question here. Byron York today pointed out on Twitter, Feinstein had meeting with Kavanaugh, could have had confidential meeting. 1,300 questions for record were submitted to Kavanaugh. This is on Twitter, so people have to write in shorthand without verbs. 32 hours of public testimony. Ford was never brought up. Is there any defense of the way that Dianne Feinstein handled this? Doesn't this look like a late hit?
The closest thing to a defense that exists right now is that people are saying that this was that Ford wanted her anonymity protected, and that's why Feinstein waited as long as she did. However, I mean, I think this could have been dealt with in private in a way that protected her anonymity, that actually protected her anonymity prior to this moment, since Feinstein had this letter and knew about this and did not bring it up. So, no, I don't think that her handling of this matter was really defensible. And in fact, if what she wanted to do was protect the anonymity of the accuser, she should have investigated it in private, should have made more of an effort rather than take this route, referring it to the FBI, which couldn't do anything, which she had to know was not going to be able to do anything. By referring it to the FBI, created headlines saying, well, this matter has been referred to the FBI. Those headlines then, of course, generated a lot of interest in who the letter writer was, who the accuser was, and ended up with, it seems like, BuzzFeed going to this woman's, I believe, either her house or her place of employment. So she felt like she was going to be outed. And then she ended up saying, well, OK, I am going to come forward and I am going to put my name on the record by talking to The Washington Post. And so the process as it was run ended up meaning that she had to do this in public. And I think that at least initially could have been avoided. And if this is this could have been decided by FBI and Senate investigators in advance behind closed doors, and it should have been.
I do think that there's possibly an incompetence over conspiracy explanation for Dianne Feinstein's behavior, though. I mean, if you are looking down the barrel of this nomination, maybe you're hopeful that Kavanaugh is going to be scotched some way other than this allegation. You sit on it for a while. You genuinely do want to preserve the anonymity of the accuser. And then it's suddenly too late. Like, I don't know. I don't know. I have no inside information. But it strikes me that it is at least as possible that the timing is down to just trying to figure out a hard thing and it taking too long rather than some kind of elaborate October surprise.
She didn't just try to figure it out and it took too long. I mean, I'll grant you, I think that is a plausible explanation in some ways, but she said she decided not to pursue the matter, didn't even share that letter with other Senate Democrats because she felt like it was better to attack Kavanaugh from a Democratic position of opposition to Kavanaugh. She said that strategically she felt like it was better to attack him on the legal merits. But then this did come out and it was referred to the FBI. And again, she had to know what the effect of referring it to the FBI after having held on to this thing for weeks at least was going to be.
I think it's worth kind of trying to come up with a new term to explain, you know, both conspiracy incompetence and acting in bad faith, because I think that's what defines the Senate right now, and it defines Congress, and it defines government and politics more broadly. Dianne Feinstein is, you know, genuinely incompetent in a lot of things. She's a bad thinker. She is doddering. I mean, and we shouldn't walk away from the fact that we're run by a gerontocracy, and it keeps coming up again and again where you have ancient people who don't know, you know, they can barely keep, you know, their feet moving, and they're making these really important decisions. I'm sure she's incompetent, and I'm sure she also acts out of bad faith, just like Mitch McConnell does, just like Harry Reid did every minute of every day. And that's part of the problem. Because, you know, now we're left in a place where it's like the worst outcomes can constantly keep happening and or are pushed. And like, you know, the whole Merrick Garland thing, like, you know, to one of the things I think that we can do at Reason is look at this stuff in context or as an ongoing story. You know, it really was shitty that Merrick Garland didn't get a vote. Technically, you know, according to the various legal experts I talked to, the Senate didn't have to have confirmation hearings. But they should have, and the Republicans should have voted him down. That would have been the right thing to do. And instead, they dicked around and they pretended that, oh, well, you know, we're going to have a new election. I mean, they end up giving themselves their own, you know, they even as they're like, you know, hanging somebody on the Democratic side, they're like creating their own noose and walking into it for the next thing down the road. And it just erodes trust and confidence in government. And it's like, at a certain point, you have to be like, what the fuck is wrong with these people? I mean, they really are genuinely bad at what they're doing, and they need to be, they need to change their behavior.
Catherine, we've already seen this morning that Brett Kavanaugh has said, this didn't happen. Nothing like this has ever happened. I'm happy to answer questions. And I think he's also retained a lawyer. Let's war game this out a second here, knowing what how she has described the incident, which is with him and Mark Judge, right? Not the Yankee right fielder, but the writer commentator were in the room. So she says this happened. They were totally wasted. They are the only people in the room, I think, according to the way that she puts it. He says this didn't happen. All right. So we have that discussion. What can we possibly learn from the hearing? And then how are the camps going to respond? I can't see this getting better or more clear with that back and forth. Can you?
Yeah, I mean, this is something, you know, I think Robbie Suave must feel like he's been in training for this day for years now, because this is a thing that we are grappling with as a culture, to just go all the way into the cliche of how do we adjudicate claims about sexual misbehavior that are very, very often he said, she said, that are often also totally lacking in substantiating physical evidence, either because time has passed or because there was never going to be any evidence to begin with, and who's, you know, where there is nonetheless an important question of guilt or innocence and character. And this is something that every single day on America's campuses, somebody is trying to deal with. And now we're just going to do it at the national level. And I think as libertarians, we're often tempted to say, listen, either go deal with it in the context of the law, right? Like there are some pretty clear laws with very clear precedent established for what rape and sexual assault look like, or let people deal with it kind of privately on the cultural level. Don't deal with it, you know, in this kind of middle, this mushy middle zone of federally mandated conduct on the part of academic administrators. And now we've basically asked the Senate to play the same role that we currently ask you know, campus honor code or misconduct committees to play. And it's impossible. We are asking an impossible thing. I think, the, you know, the other place that this takes me back to is Emily Yaffe, who, as Dear Prudence and also as a chronicler of the fallout from Title IX, comes back over and over to, like, you know what's bad? Drinking till you black out. Don't do it. Because there's not just the immediate bad things. There's also bad things like this that happen to both parties all the way down the line. And, you know, I am not a teetotaler, but I certainly feel the truth of Emily Yaffe's take in the context of
this
debate.
Was the woman drinking at that event? I mean, or she was not talking about being a blackout drunk. And actually, Kavanaugh didn't admit that either. I mean, that's creeping in partly
right.
because
but
Mark
have,
Judge has written a memoir of being a teenage
right.
blackout.
So we have these... We have these other sort of secondary sources creeping in. But again, often at issue in cases that involve drinking is precisely how drunk each party was.
Sure.
And no one's in a position to know. You know, I think, again, this doesn't help resolve the question. I don't know that we can get to a true truth that is deeply true in the universal
would
sense
it be,
about this.
Do you think it would be beneficial, though, to have, you know, and assuming it's done in as a kind of... fair, you know, a format as possible to have her speak and to have Kavanaugh, you know, address that. Because, I mean, and I guess in a lot of court cases, in the end, it does come down to, you know, one side versus the other. And, you know, would they be, you know, would, and apart from establishing what actually happened, which is virtually impossible, you know, would that, would having that kind of dialogue or scene, would that actually help to quell the sense that things are not being done well, or would that just inflame more people?
Just to throw in a piece of relevant information here, the attorney for Christine Ford said this morning that Ford would be willing to testify and that she believes that what she experienced was an attempted rape. So she is, at least, it may well be that if this continues, if Kavanaugh does not withdraw and we have an additional hearing, she has said she would be willing at this point to go in and testify.
But I don't think there's any way that a public conversation in which the two of them each make the best case for themselves, like, heals any of the wounds or gets us to a resolution that's not, you know, grudging and fought down to the last second. I mean, Peter is right. Like, there was a version of that conversation that could have happened either directly or indirectly in private a while ago that might have been very good for all parties. And if she wanted to stay anonymous, obviously they couldn't have been in the same room at the same time, but to formally acquire both of their statements and grapple with those privately, you know, that is a possible road. And again, this is exactly what's happening on college campuses. So, you know, the right to know the accusations against oneself and to deal with them directly, like, that isn't our status quo in due process on campus sexual claims right now. It is often the case that people simply know that they have been accused of something. They don't know by whom. They don't know when. They don't know how to answer the charges. They often are not even given the opportunity to do so. Some of that has gotten a little bit better in the last couple of years. But there would have been asynchronous privacy-protecting ways to do this. I think it is now too late. Like, any kind of full reckoning of the story, even if both parties attempt to give it in their own best good faith, as you say, memory is tricky, yeah, and there's so much at stake now.
So what happens, though, like, because if Kavanaugh drops out or is pressured to drop out because of the politics of the situation, that is pouring gasoline on the situation. And you're going to, you know, I mean, that you can already, you know, project out 1,000 years worth of tweets from the from Kavanaugh supporters or from people on the right about that. If he goes forward, you can do the same on the left. Like, what I you know, and I'm saying this as if, you know, Matt, you haven't actually given your specific take on anything, but like, what do you think should happen? What would be in the best interest of the country as opposed to the individuals who are kind of enmeshed in this?
I think that there's no way out of the situation of she will testify, or she should testify in front of the Senate. She should give, she should be cross-examined. She will give her tearful testimony. He should be there then cross-examined, and he will say, it didn't happen. And then we will go to our corners believing even more strongly what we believed it going in. I don't think that there's any corroborating evidence that you can get. I mean, having a 2012 couples therapy session notes from your therapist, some of which are in disparity on some details from what she has mentioned, is, I don't, you know, that doesn't really get us very far. And so I think, like a lot of other things in politics, we're in a bad place. It's going to get worse. And I don't see how this gets to more resolution. You can't. How do you not listen to her? And people care about this. And we have at least two or three members, Republican members of the Judiciary Committee, Lisa Murkowski and Jeff Flake, saying we should certainly delay it until we can adjudicate this aspect of it. But there's, for me, it's a single source story, a single source allegation about something that happened 35 years ago. We spent a lot of time at Reason talking about the murkiness of eyewitness testimony, as Catherine was alluding to, the the difficulty in just sussing out the truth in sexual assault cases. Also, there's the question of the more so in actual criminal cases than in this particular case, because it's not a criminal case, but the kind of injustice of saddling minors with heavy-handed punishments. I mean, one interesting line of argument that I've seen from Rosa Brooks, Elizabeth Nolan Brown included this in her roundup this morning, but from Rosa Brooks and Tom Nichols, and I think Megan McArdle also out there saying this. I don't know if I myself believe this, but there's an idea of like, hey, it kind of almost doesn't matter what a 17-year-old does, or like we should not be derailing someone's career based on even heinous actions of a 17-year-old. I don't know if I go that far. If it's an attempted rape by a 17-year-old or a 15-year-old, that's kind of difficult to accept. I'm not sure that that's what this is, and I'm pretty sure that we won't be able to know. And that's very problematic. And in fact, I would
just add to this, to the pile of weakness, not pile of evidence, but pile of weakness here is that the New Yorker, which wrote about this before we knew Ford's name, included a line saying that a source familiar with the committee's activities said that Feinstein's staff initially conveyed to other Democratic members offices that the incident was too distant in the past to merit public discussion. So there's reporting suggesting that Feinstein and her people thought that this sort of didn't rise to the level of of being worth considering.
I think that's one way. And again, this is totally bruising on every level, but you know, this is the type of thing where Feinstein wants to be a profile in Courage. You know, she should really openly say that, because, you know, that would also explain her behavior in a pretty clear cut way. But that would be the beginning of stepping out of the political scripts, which is what is driving people nuts about, you know, fucking politics. It's like everything is just, you know, because people were looking for reasons to get rid of Kavanaugh, just like they were looking to, you know, for reasons to cock block Merrick Garland and stuff like that. And at some point it's got to stop, you know, and people, I mean, like Jeff Flake, to his credit, you know, he got bounced. He's leaving the Senate mostly because he didn't have the stomach to be as big a political hack, or I guess maybe as big a political hero as he needed to be. But we need like some kind of rebalancing here.
Also, because he appears to have felt like his voters wanted him to be more of a hack than he wanted to be. And he didn't really, it's not just that he didn't want to fight with them. He felt that he would lose that fight with the people who he needed to keep.
Yeah, no, that he was unlikely to win his re-election re-nomination.
But
the whole point of, I'm sorry, just real quickly, the whole shitty Profiles in Courage, which is a book that John F. Kennedy had written for him, for which he won a Pulitzer Prize, it was about senators who went against their constituents' will in order to make a courageous decision. And, you know, it would be nice to hear somebody in the fucking Senate bring that up in a moment like this while they are actually doing what they think is right, even if it costs them electorally or politically.
So I want to ask, though, it feels like this last minute twist in the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings is sort of almost tailor-made for all of the fights that we're having in this cultural political moment. And so my question is, would this have happened to anyone, right? Like any nominee, any Republican nominee in particular being vetted right now, everyone and their sister would have gone looking for a Me Too. And
would it have happened with Barrett?
It's something else. Like, yeah, but like that, the,
but
this
no, but
moment
I actually think
calls
specific,
for some kind
I think
of last
specifically,
minute twist.
A Me Too, like not just the last minute twist, but like this sort of convergence of, because the perception is that what's at stake here is essentially women's rights or abortion rights, because of the perception that Republicans stand against that, because of the increasingly tendentious culture war way that fight is being played out, like, and because everyone did something stupid when they were 17, would this have happened no matter what? And I think that is a question that I don't know the answer to. Like, everybody did do something stupid when they're 17, but not everybody did something stupid enough to be accused of sexual assault. On the other hand, everybody probably is missing at least some point of their teenage years in their full memory for a variety of reasons and could be accused, even if they didn't do anything wrong. I guess I'm just wondering, like, was the Me Too accusation that brings down Republican nomination, like, was that almost an inevitability given, like, the plot arc of this season of American politics?
I mean, if we're going to look at things in terms of serial television shows, yes, if you assume that we are in episode 9 of 13 and just about to break into the third act here. But as tempting as it is to look at American politics as a television show, and as often as I do, I don't think that is actually the correct way to look at how these things
Do you think we should look at it as a multiplayer, a massive online multiplayer game?
Obviously, that's where I'm going with this. No, I mean, I think that this would not necessarily... I think it's possible that it would have happened with another candidate. I think you're right to ask the question, but I don't think that it was predetermined and definitely necessary. I think we can say, though, Democrats had a weak hand in opposing this nominee. And as a result, Democrats were going to look for and perhaps take extraordinary and unusual tactical measures to oppose this nominee, since just on the vote merits, they basically couldn't do anything else. And so it seems counterfactuals are just impossible to run. And in many ways, I kind of don't. It's so speculative, and maybe I shouldn't, and I don't really want to sort of speculate. And yet it seems plausible to me to say that, well, if it wasn't this, there might have been, with a different nominee, there might have been a different sort of unusual event to sort of surface attack that also had some other cultural valence.
It could
also
have been race, right? But I do feel like if there's always a sort of balance between are we more upset about sex than race, we're clearly more upset about sex right now.
At the same time, though, I mean, I don't know how much mileage there really is in running these counterfactuals and in speculating. Here now.
I guess
we now sort of have to figure out what we're going to do about this in particular. And I basically agree with Matt and with what Robbie Suave wrote yesterday at Reason.com, which is that these accusations, now that they are public, now that we've seen the letter, now that we know her name, it's quite unfortunate that they came this late, and Feinstein should be, I think, criticized for her handling, but we do need some sort of public hearing. We need to go through this, and we need to ask the questions. We need to do it in front of the American public and in front of the senators who are going to be voting to confirm.
I still think, though, that the reason to ask the question the way I asked it is, how much are we making both Kavanaugh and his accuser be symbols rather than individuals, and how bad is that? Because I'm open to using Supreme Court nominations as essentially symbolic conversations. And I think we have done that in the nation's recent past, even. But I guess I want us to be self-aware about whether these people were just ciphers
in return, if we're going to treat these folks as symbols, do you think this is a valuable and productive discussion of cultural and political symbology? Do you think we're going to get somewhere that is useful? I mean, if Kavanaugh ends up withdrawing, that will be in the very short term, that will be a tactical victory for Democrats. I'm not sure it will actually be a long-term strategic victory, since Republicans are likely to just nominate someone else, someone perhaps even more conservative. And depending on how that goes, it could drive Republican turnout in the midterms. But it would be a tactical victory. But like, are we getting, and I want to ask you specifically, Catherine, but to everybody else, is there a productive discussion to be had using these two people as cultural and political symbols, if that's what's going on?
I think the version of this conversation that we had around Bill Clinton looked like it had been productive, that we had as a nation kind of come to a grudging agreement about how much we were going to value that type of behavior on the part of our important menfolk. And it turned out that it was not resolved at all, that it was buried and that it has reemerged in precisely the form that we are grappling with right now. So I think there could be a productive version. I think that we do need to get to a new basic agreement. It may be impossible.
And just to follow up on that, towards the end of the 90s, Kathy Young wrote for Reason a story that kind of made that case that the reaction to Bill Clinton and the refusal on the part of the U.S. Senate to actually remove him from office after he, you know, during his impeachment trial, was a sign that I think the headline was something like groping towards sanity on gender war issues, and recognizing that women moving into the workforce and, you know, into higher education and then the workforce in equal or in large numbers as well as in equal positions to men, there was a lot of social change that was happening and a lot of tumult, and not all of it was bad faith or awful. It was just like an understandable collision of a new time and kind of social and cultural and workplace relationships and arrangements. I think you're right that what we have been finding out, at least in the past, you know, several years, is that we didn't actually settle anything. We just brushed it away. And when you go back and you look at the stuff of, you know, Gloria Steinem talking about the one free grope policy that, you know, essentially articulated a line saying that if a man is pro-choice and is considered good on women's issues, they get a pass on certain types of behavior. That seemed to be ending when people like Al Franken got booted from the Senate in a way that I think a lot of people thought was unfair. I mean, he certainly did, and a lot of his progressive supporters. The way that I think we can have a productive discussion is if what happens going forward is taken out of the, you know, I mean, and I think it has to be done explicitly. And I don't know that it will help anybody in the immediate term, but to say we have to push this beyond politics and about just trying to, you know, win by scotching Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation or pushing it through no matter what, because there is long and ongoing damage to institutional reputation, which fucks up all sorts of things and makes it less likely that women will come forward or that men will behave in different ways and things like that. I think we can have that. But I doubt that we will, because we're already seeing, you know, the context of everything is so fucking political and so fucking partisan, to a point where before this, when it looked like Kavanaugh was screwed, you know, you saw a lot of people on the left saying he needs to be removed for perjury and for lying because he didn't admit that he had heard Alex Kaczynski, you know, Judge Alex Kaczynski, who he clerked for, tell dirty jokes. Like, and he had to have heard Alex Kaczynski tell dirty jokes. And the fact that he denied that means he's a liar and he needs to be. I mean, like, we've gotten to this level of bizarreness in politics. And I think we can get past that. But I'm not very hopeful in this particular moment.
One way to answer or to address, Catherine, your question before we shift gears here is I think, like Tom Nichols, I'm like around Brett Kavanaugh's age, and you know, my teenage years, or not in high school but in college, were not necessarily covered in personal glory. So you can't help but start like thinking about your own damn self on these things narcissistically. But ask yourself the question: has anyone from your past, as you have risen in public stature, come out, or even someone that you might have worked with in the past, come out and said stuff about you that isn't true in a public forum on Facebook or whatever, in a way that made you go, what are you even talking about? My answer to that question is yes. On a couple of occasions, people have said things about me that aren't remotely true, just like crazy town stuff. Because if you live long enough, you're going to have people who freak out on you one way or the other. Now, imagine if you actually mattered.
Especially if your name rises in prominence and sort of becomes part of the public consciousness.
Yeah. So that, to me, doesn't necessarily cast doubt on this, but what on the accusation, what it does to me is say, again, make you think, okay, this is a single source thing. I would definitely want to see either more evidence for the thing, or more pattern of behavior out there, because this is how things happen, and that's a standard that's going to be awful hard if we're going to have single allegations against activities, behaviors that happened 35 years ago. Boy, that's it's easy to see how this can get pear-shaped in our overheated and never lessening kind of political culture war. And I'm going to.
I want to put like one tiny coda on that, which is just I also think it's a very different worldview about whether you think the fact that there is or isn't a pattern matters. And people are on both sides of that. I mean, there are people who would just say, you know, you don't need a pattern of behavior. You don't need multiple. You shouldn't need multiple accusers. You
right.
should,
just if there is one murder is enough. Yeah.
One murder is enough. One rape is enough. One, you know, sexual assault is enough. Like, and I think that's a defensible view. That's certainly how our judicial system operates. And so, again, there's a sort of this very difficult problem of if there was a pattern, you would give any individual allegation credence, but it doesn't actually give you any information really about the truth of one specific thing. And if you think one incident when someone is 17, if it's bad enough, is bad enough, you're in a tricky position as far as getting your proof, but the moral claim is still there.
And the fact that it happened when appears to have happened, she actually doesn't remember the exact time, but it appears to have happened, she alleges that it probably happened when he was 17, when he was a minor. And so we have an additional layer of kind of cultural complication there, which is that we often think that even quite bad behavior when you are a minor should be basically you get a pass on that as an adult, and it shouldn't count towards your sort of our understanding of your character. I'm not saying that that is the correct way to view this necessarily. I'm just saying that that is a relatively common thing, right? We seal the records of minors in many cases, and so that further complicates the job, the business of coming to any sort of collective agreement or understanding about how exactly to
approach. But when you put it that way too, Peter, I mean, can we all agree, and maybe we don't, but that the event then as described, and without knowing Kavanaugh's mindset too, because it was, you know, the woman says that she experienced it as an attempted rape, and that, you know, that is her prerogative to believe that, to feel that or to think that. Did he necessarily, and are we really going to say that that one event rises to the level of, you know, that has to define his entire, you know, career ultimately? And it means he should not only be denied Supreme Court seat, but he should probably be kicked out of, you know, his current job, right? And it seems like when you start working it from that direction, this seems, you know, really a really hard thing to say. Now, this really needs to be a line in the sand that we put cement around and really make sure that this, you know, this is true in all cases, in all places, because it's, you know, like that does seem to be a pretty thin reed on which to base a cosmic view of justice, which I think is what you were getting at.
Here's how I would answer that question, Nick, and it's a dodge. Let's be clear about it, is that if there was videotape of the event as she described, documentary evidence mm-hmm. that I could assess for myself, and it was exactly as she described, and somehow it communicated the one of the more curious lines that she said, which is, I thought he might inadvertently kill me, if it sort of like communicated that sense, then I would say, yes, that would be enough if we had that. But we're not going to have that. Mm-hmm. And so that's going, because we're not going to have that provides too much doubt in my mind. I mean, maybe we'll find some weird documentary evidence that we don't currently have, but that's how I look at something that happens.
And I'd add just that if we, presuming that we somehow could establish very strongly with evidence that this did happen, what that would also mean is that Kavanaugh is lying. And
right.
And not
that's
just
a current
saying,
offense.
I made a very bad mistake when I was a minor, but lying. And so, again, that presume I'm talking about a situation in which we actually did establish with absolute certainty that this happened as she is now describing.
Unless he was too wasted to remember.
But then but then you also, like, the larger context here, and this is the one that we can kind of control or that can change regardless of how this plays out, which is that if the Senate wasn't widely held in such low repute because the people in the Senate are bullshit artists and are liars. Ted Cruz called Mitch McConnell, his majority leader, a liar. Ted Cruz is a liar. And not simply like in a political sense. These are people, and they're on the left too, or on the Democratic side of the aisle, who just make shit up and are kind of batshit crazy and act in bad faith all the time. If this was all in a larger context where this was an aberration and a tough call in an otherwise kind of, you know, generally above board institution, we wouldn't be wringing our hands the same way. I mean, that's where I think the energy has to go, where it's like, you know, let's have a fucking functioning Senate and a functioning House of Representatives. I mean, you know, and this is, I mean, to talk about Congress and people like that. I mean, when you hear Justin Amash, the way that he bashes Paul Ryan, the outgoing Speaker of the House, you know, nobody should have confidence in Paul Ryan or the House as an institution, because it has been run by a lot of bad people, including an actual child molester a few sessions ago. But you know, it's not working. And that's the larger context that I think we can always be insisting on and improving.
Let's
I know we want to escape this topic, but just to add one more layer to the onion, like that thing that you just described, though, the lack of faith in institutions and the lack of faith in particular in the good motivations of the key players in those institutions is a reason to be hesitant about confirming Kavanaugh. I mean, There is already a very serious disease of like a particular type of sort of attribution of bad faith to male Republicans on the part of women who are on the other side of the aisle, that they don't care about women, that they don't value mm-hmm. women, that they don't want women to thrive. I think that is generally an unfair accusation. People legitimately disagree about important issues, but it's going to discredit subsequent Supreme Court decisions if a good chunk of the country thinks that they are basically the work of an illegitimately selected rapist.
Yeah, I agree. And also, you know, to Kavanaugh, I don't think helped, you know, and obviously since Bork, no Supreme Court nominee will ever say anything about anything when they're being confirmed, because like to actually argue your points or what you believe is a disaster. It would have been really nice to have heard Kavanaugh say even something, you know, and I'm sure this is like beyond the pale, but, you know, like, I don't believe in abortion. I think abortion is wrong. I don't think, you know, and I think that the law currently is okay, though, or it's like, you know, it's not going anywhere. And, you know, it wouldn't bind him in any way, shape or form. But like, instead of people pretending that they're not just ideologically pro-choice or pro-life and they're going to do everything they can to switch the situation the way they want, is, you know, it beggars the belief of a halfway intelligent viewer, you know, because you know these people are fucking lying. And, you know, Kavanaugh was picked partly because he's pro-life. But we can never actually say that, right?
So Nick referenced Paul Ryan. I'm going to use that as an opportunity to get us out of this walking on eggshells conversation, stomping on eggshells conversation, I should say, because it's a useful and vigorous discussion. But over the weekend, in fact, Nick blogged about this because that's all he does, is blog all the time. Paul Kane from The Washington Post declared that the deficit hawks are officially dead, with the death certificate coming last week in the form of the Congressional Budget Office estimating the deficit for fiscal year 2018, just for the first 11 months of it, at right around $900 billion. Dollars. Nick, in your write-up of this, you pinned a lot of the blame on Paul Ryan. Why you got to go after Peter's special friend Paul like that?
Yeah, because Paul Ryan, you know, and as he, I think, became a congressman in 1999, he has voted for every major expansion of government under a Republican and some under a Democrat. Whenever he had the opportunity, he increased spending massively. And he, you know, he's like Mr., you know, deficit hawk. He's Mr. Budget wonk and all of that kind of stuff. He never was serious about doing anything. And then on his watch, you know, deficits and spending ballooned. I mean, they've expanded. He's only been in office, what, like 15 months or so. And he's done nothing except, you know, drive down receipts and or rather increase deficits. He didn't drive down receipts per se.
It's great and hilarious to watch the annual deficit expansion since the moment that Republicans had unified control of Congress. I think it's gone from like 400 or so billion to now we're going back to 1 trillion with a Republican president as well. Peter, you like to luxuriate in CBO death porn. Can you tell us how screwed we are?
Pretty screwed. Like on a scale of extremely screwed to somewhat less screwed.
There we go. That's fine.
Okay.
We're pretty screwed, I'd say. We're at $21 trillion in debt. We are now pushing into trillion-dollar deficits that we just did not need to be running. So what happened if you want to go back to the Bush and Obama administrations, is that Bush drove up the deficit, which had really come down towards the end of the Clinton years. Bush drove up the deficit. In particular, it spiked during the last year that Bush was in office. And then, of course, along with that, the first year of that Obama was in office, deficits ran over $1 trillion for Obama's first term. And then they started to come down they were still projected to rise slowly, start rising again over the 2020s and over this decade. But Trump and the Republican Congress have really pushed deficits back up much, much faster than they were going to otherwise. And that is mostly a result of the tax bill, but also a result of the bipartisan spending bill, their spending package that was passed earlier this year. And what Republicans have done here they spent 8 years under Obama complaining about the deficit, and then immediately their biggest single effect on the budget is to run up deficits and to ensure that we have trillion-dollar deficits for years and years to come again. And what I think that does, it's not just that they are having these sort of specific mathematical effect on the budget. What they are doing is making absolutely clear, not that we were really uncertain about this before, but making absolutely clear that their concerns about the deficit are entirely hypocritical, entirely designed as a sort of partisan weapon to get Democrats to try and restrain themselves when Democrats are in power. And so what's going to happen now is the next time Democrats end up in power, and there will be a time at some point, Democrats are going to say, why in the world should we care about any of this? And they are going to use Republican hypocrisy as an excuse to pass even more massive spending programs into effect. And so it's not just the particular numbers we're looking at now. It's the knock-on political effects, because, and this goes back to what Nick was talking about, everything is now used as a sort of partisan tactic. And the deficit concerns that Republicans expressed under Obama were, I think, the evidence has proven, has shown, were basically just there as a partisan tactic to try and drive opposition to Obama's agenda, and to try and get Democrats to do things like what they did with the Affordable Care Act, which was quasi sort of pretend to pay for it on paper by raising a bunch of taxes and then cutting a bunch of spending from Medicare. And so at least it did at least score as deficit neutral on paper. Now, Republicans and Democrats are looking at repealing a bunch of those taxes and a bunch of those pay-fors there, leaving the spending in place, of course. And so, again, the long-term political effect is just that everybody drives the other side to behave very badly when it comes to budgeting. And it's not that much of a problem today. It's probably not that much of a problem tomorrow or Thursday or Friday or Monday of next week. We'll probably be fine. And in fact, the economy's doing pretty well. But the real long-term problem is when interest rates rise, as they will unexpectedly at some point, and we don't know when that point will be, when interest rates rise, we are going to be stuck with giant amounts of debt and debt service, and it is going to totally hose the American budget and the economy.
Catherine, let's sketch out that exact scenario a little bit more here. So eventually we're at the ninth year of an economic expansion. These things don't tend to last much longer than 9 years, usually more like 7, maybe even 6. So that comes to an end. You get the rising interest rates. Economic expansion comes to an end. Democrats now control at least the House, maybe the Senate, too. They've already passed some bigger spending, Bernie Sanders stuff, gotten some signatures from Donald Trump. Now we have a recession. There's greater demand for public services. There are fewer tax receipts coming in. Neither political party gives anything like a credible rat's patootie about controlling a deficit the size of government. What happens?
So this is the part where you get the split in the thinking about what magical thing will solve that problem. And Democrats, by and large, want to magically solve that problem with the rich. They're going to tax the rich. They're going to get the money that the rich people have and put it in the big hole that they made in the government and fill it up, and it will be fine. And Republicans have an equally mathematically illiterate and irrational hope that growth will fill the hole. There will be growth, and they will grow over the hole, and the hole will be full, and it will be fine. And, of course, in your scenario, you rightly note that growth tends to be cyclical, and that if we have been booming for a bit, a bust will be upon us. The immediate plan, though, to reinstate growth by doing things Republicans wanted to do anyway, which used to at least pay some lip service to cutting the size of government and now only are cutting taxes and, in fact, spending more. So that's what's going to happen. What's going to happen is that everyone will retreat to their same sort of, comfort object and pretend like that will be even remotely near the scale of dealing with the problem, and it will not be.
Economic growth is the emotional support animal. Emotional
basically,
support blanket
it's like it's
for
the
Republicans.
It's the lovey of the Republicans. Like they just sit in the corner with their laughter.
Their growth blankie. Yes, I would. We should get those for the office when it's really cold.
It's really sad. You mean?
same. Honest. Right. The CBO basically says there's three ways that you can address the debt problem in the main. One is you could pretty much zero out all discretionary spending. Seems unlikely. Another is you could have really large tax hikes across the board, not just on the rich, on everybody. That's people making $40,000 a year, making $25,000 a year, making $125,000 a year. Really, like a pretty significant across the board tax hike, even if you made the tax hike somewhat progressive in structure. You just can't get the money only by taxing the rich. And finally, you can dramatically curtail entitlement spending. Probably if you wanted to take a reasonable approach to this, you would need to do some combination of these things that is heaviest on tax hikes and entitlement cuts, with the bulk of the action coming from entitlements. But, there's sort of two problems here, Democrats and Republicans. Democrats say you can never cut entitlements. And increasingly, I should add, Republicans are saying this, too. They're running against Medicare for All by saying that we really have to preserve Medicare, fairly similar to how they argued against Obamacare. And Republicans say you can never, ever raise a dollar in taxes. And if you look at the other countries that have brought down their deficits and dealt with these problems, it tends to be a very small amount of targeted tax hikes with big cuts to spending.
I would point out that, we look at Donald Trump as being this sort of newish figure here of someone who campaigned kind of openly. Look, no, I'm going to protect your Social Security and entitlements. And also I'm going to spend a hell of a lot more on immigration enforcement, and we got to restore the military and this kind of stuff, and just didn't see.
And he wants to do a $1 trillion infrastructure bill.
Sure.
A $1 trillion infrastructure. People, and like his own advisors are like, that seems high. And he's like, nope, $1 trillion.
Mitt Romney ran on the same stuff minus the infrastructure bill in 2012. We tend to forget the extent to which Mitt Romney was an ideological precursor to Trump in a moment when the Tea Party actually was a thing and had some people, and there was real kind of, you know, debt ceiling discussions and an attempt to restrain spending on Capitol Hill. At that exact moment, the person who won the GOP nomination was the one in the field who had the biggest amount of spending fantasia, who might say, yeah, we should cut government, but then we have to increase spending on all kinds of different things while protecting the old age entitlement system.
And also never actually specifying a single thing he would cut.
Correct.
As he called for cuts.
Yes.
When somebody writes a secret op-ed, by the way, with the word spending fantasia in it, that's how we're going to know it was you.
That's
Matt.
Your
yeah,
mode
that's,
star.
That's
I absolutely. Think, you know, one of the questions here is there's a financial reality that's going to come. And that's, you know, part of what Peter's talking about and the CBO is channeling, which is that entitlement spending is already driving, you know, all sorts of spending decisions in the budget. It doesn't have to be renewed every year or, you know, or approved again. And it's already creeping up towards 70% of government payments are automatic. You know, so the discretionary budget doesn't matter. What Trump has shown and the Republicans have shown is that to the extent that it does, and the discretionary budget includes defense spending, they are always ready to spend more on defense spending. It doesn't matter. So you've got, you know, all of the pressures are for upward spending. In 2008 was the first year that the U.S. started spending 20%. The federal government started spending 20% of GDP, the equivalent of 20% of GDP. It hasn't gone below that. And it shows no sign of doing that. That's up from towards the end of the Clinton years. We were looking at like 17%, 18% of GDP, which is closer to the actual tax revenue that historically the U.S. has been able to squeeze out of people, regardless of whether we had really high individual rates for taxes. We had higher business taxes. We had, you know, more. It was the country taxed a lot more in the 50s and 60s. In 70s, and it still couldn't get more than about 18% of GDP in tax revenue. Anything that we do that doesn't bring spending down towards 18% is a mug's game. Because even if you increase taxes and manage to cover deficits for a while, people will figure out ways to get around that and stuff like that. And I think what we need to be doing is really making the arguments when the interest rates go up, when money starts getting more expensive, when people recognize that the end is coming and we do need to shift stuff. What are the arguments to get rid of entitlement spending? Entitlement spending, the way that we're doing it, old age entitlements comes out of, you know, Bismarck's idea of co-opting socialists and placating people so that they don't have revolutions. We're not in that world anymore. We're not even in FDR's 1935 when Social Security was passed. We're not even in the late 60s when Medicare passed. We need to fundamentally be rethinking what government is doing, because right now it's ratcheting up to be more and more a part of the economy. And if we don't come up with arguments against that, we're never going to be able to shift that.
I think you're right about the budget and sort of the difficulty of raising more than 18 or 19% of GDP historically in the United States. I mean, your research is right, but I also think that that's in part because we've never tried a VAT, a value-added tax, basically a kind of national sales tax that takes place at every level of the production line. And that's how the European economies raise so much money. I'm not saying that that's a good idea, but the VATs are efficient, effective revenue raisers. And in fact, there's a libertarian argument that we should be taxing consumption.
Absolutely.
And that we should move away income-based taxes towards a VAT.
Absolutely.
That then pays for the actual spending that we have.
Let's have the conversation, right, though, that we, you know, and also the idea that revenue is what you raise in order to pay for the government services you purchase. And the more that you can do that in the same year that they're levied, it's all the better. Because part of the problem, too, is that, like, right now, and I have also written recently about teacher pay and whatnot. One of the ways in which teachers are being screwed is that more and more of their compensation is going into their retirements. But those retirements will not actually be there for them when they're ready to collect them. So a lot of us, like, we're paying more and more for government services that we either don't want or won't get, but we're doing it on the cheap because we're running deficits. So it's, you know, I mean, the fact is that, like, if you can get nominally a dollar's worth of government spending for 70 cents because we're borrowing 30% or whatever, you of course you're going to go for it on the margins. If we were actually paying fully what we were getting from the government, I think that the demand for government services would decline.
Government spending ends up being like one of those teaser rate mortgages that Elizabeth Warren hates, right? It's like 2 years where it's really cheap, and then the APR jumps up after 2 or 4 years,
except
and it turns out to be really expensive.
We're in year 17 right. of a super discount where you can get a dollar's worth of government spending for as little as, you know, 68 cents or maybe only 80 cents. So, you know, what a bargain.
Elizabeth Warren should run on this in 2020 about how the government has deceptively about how government spending is deceptive, and eventually we're all going to have to pay a lot more for it than we've been told.
I haven't run the numbers in a long time, but back in the last go round of $1 trillion deficits during Obama's first term, I was fond of taking Bill Clinton's last budget and increasing it, or I should say, accurately, the last budget while Bill Clinton was president, increasing it only by the growth of population plus inflation, we would have been running surpluses this whole time if we had just kept government at the same per capita level of expenditure as we had in 1999 and 2000. We wouldn't be talking about these crazy debts. We'd be talking about deficits. I'm pretty sure that's true. The other thing I would add is that Mick Mulvaney always deserves a special smack to the head on this stuff. In March 2015, he wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed that said, quote, "There is no honest way to justify not paying for spending, no matter how often my fellow Republicans try." And then 30 months later, a member of the Trump administration, he says, "We need to have new deficits." Well, congratulations, Mick Mulvaney. You got your new deficits and we're all screwed. Let's shift to the end of show. What the hell you have been consuming out there here. I'm going to start because I want to issue a rare defense here of all of the ridiculous hurricane coverage by various cable networks and everything. People love to complain. Like, I can't believe that they get their person with their windbreaker flapping in the wind and being all dramatic. I love every minute of it. The only thing I like better than that are car chases in LA, which are the best form of news, period. Also television and entertainment. This is what we have television for. It's pure distilled greatness, especially that dude from the Weather Channel who's going to fall over in the grass while the two dude bros were walking by calmly. And of course, the single best bit of cinema that we have seen perhaps all year, perhaps all decade, was that incredible Weather Channel graphic with the gal standing and then suddenly it rises up and you can even see the fishes in the water. Oh my God, that's great. I love every minute of it. I defend all of it. We should do more of this, not less. What have you been consuming, Nick Gillespie?
I have been watching a very funny show called, on Amazon streaming called A Very English Scandal, which is based on a mid-70s scandal where a British member of parliament, the head of the Liberal Party, actually, who was secretly gay, was trying to have his former lover killed. Hugh Grant is in it. It is fucking hilarious. It's 3 episodes long. And I highly recommend it. It also helps plug in, you know, this is the type of scandal that helped elect Margaret Thatcher towards the end of the 70s. And we often forget how much sex scandals actually have massive changes in political outcomes. Going back to 2006 and the piece I wrote about the death of deficit hawks, in 2006, the Democratic Party ran very credibly and very successfully as deficit hawks. That was the last stand of the Blue Dog Democrats. And they were talking about cutting spending because Bush was taking it out of control and off the books through war spending and a bunch of other stuff, including Medicare expansion, which wasn't paid for. And a lot of Democrats actually voted against because it wasn't paid for in the budget. But then the Mark Foley scandal hit shortly before the midterms in 2006 and definitely helped swing the partisan power pendulum to the Democrats, who immediately, of course, got into office and then you know, started spending badly. But having said that, the A Very English Scandal is a very, very funny watch.
I would just add that that's back when we still had a functioning Wonkette, and that that season had about 1,000 hilarious names. The Mark Foley season, and my favorite one was Cocktober. Peter, what have you been consuming?
I watched last night the new Nicolas Cage movie, Mandy, which features Nick Cage as probably a lumberjack, but possibly some sort of ageless demigod who whose wife or significant other, Mandy, is kidnapped by a sex cult with the help of a biker gang that took some very bad LSD and now wears exclusively like spiked mask type Hellraiser costumes. And so she's burned alive in front of him. And then Nick Cage goes back to his cabin, cries for like 2 full minutes in the bathroom, drinks like a full fifth of vodka in a single take, and then goes and retrieves his sniper crossbow from a friend played by Bill Duke, smelts a legendary battle axe, and proceeds to murder absolutely every one of them for the next hour. Wow. And it's phenomenal.
Why does this exist?
Who directed that?
Panos Cosmatos.
Panos.
It is, it really, it captures like being trapped in like a druggy heavy metal fever dream in the best possible way. It's just, it's beautifully shot. The music is just sort of crazily enveloping. And the, even though it's, I mean, obviously from my description, you can imagine it gets quite gory. It's not sort of violently disturbing. It's actually kind of hypnotic.
So it's like The Revenant. The Revenant, but you actually want to watch it?
And shorter.
Okay. So like I said, again, so you want to watch it.
So it's in some theaters, but I would just I would say for anybody who's interested by my description, as you all should be, this is on video on demand. It looks great on a big OLED television with a home surround sound system. Highly recommended for Sunday night viewing pleasure.
What you just described is something I will never willingly submit myself to. Catherine, speaking of submission, what have you been reading?
The contrast here is going to be just super, super glorious. I would like to recommend a candy-colored 22-minute sitcom. I recommended
it's like a palate cleanser for after. Like, yes. This is a double feature.
I recommended the first season before on this podcast. The second season is now available on Netflix. The Good Place, if you have not seen it, it's glorious. It is a sitcom where each episode is also a classic philosophical problem. It features... spoiler alert for those who have not seen it. They are not actually in heaven. They are actually in hell.
Because that's where your life is built around solving classical philosophical
problems.
No, that's
literally one of the four people being tortured in hell is a moral philosopher. And there's an ongoing joke in the show that's like, yeah, obviously the moral philosopher is like the darkest sinner who should be in the deepest part of hell. Among other things, they sometimes figure out that they are not in heaven because they are not allowed to use profanity. So I say to you, mother forking shirt balls, you should go see this show.
That's beautiful. That's a nice way to cap this up. You've been listening to the Reason Podcast Editor's Roundtable Edition. Subscribe to our action there on iTunes. Rate us and review us. And my God, if we survive this week, we'll be back next Monday as well. Bye, everyone.